Life.
Table.
Dignity.
Security.
Free.
Jump.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Like justice.
Justice. Justice.
Just this.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
And protection.
Fairness.
Fair trial.
Criticism.
Right.
Well.
Peace.
Movement.
Movement.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall. And I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression. Expression.
Expression.
Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Culture.
Culture.
Human rights.
Cartagena.
Solidarity.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and my special guest today is Denise McDonald, who is going to talk with us this afternoon about a subject close to her heart, permaculture.
Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome, Denise. Yeah. And, you know, it's one word, but boy, once you get started looking at it, it's huge.
It is. It's actually, made up of two words, which is permanent and agriculture, or permanent and culture. So permaculture is a movement, a social movement that is in, you know, over 100 countries in the world with many thousands of grassroots projects on the ground.
Well, where do we start? What is there sort of a demarcation point where sort of permaculture started, or is it kind of always been there and people are paying more attention to it?
Well, permaculture began with two men in Australia, one named David Holmgren and one named Bill Mollison. And in 1974, they published two books, Permaculture 1 and Permaculture 2. And then in 1979, they established the Permaculture Institute. And ever since then, it has just taken off like wildfire. So they had an international conference in 1984. And there has been there's been 11 international conferences since then. There are permaculture convergences all over the world now. They're like local, national, international, regional. And basically, there's a certification process. So it's not just something where, to become a permaculture expert, you can get a permaculture design certificate. So it's a 72-hour course. And I was lucky enough to take it a couple of years ago, and you learn a lot. And like you say, it's a really huge topic. But essentially, it seeks to create systems that are ecologically sound and economically viable. the systems which provide for their own needs do not exploit or pollute, and therefore are sustainable in the long term. And, you know, its purpose is to create a permanent culture through sustainable food and energy production. So it is, it covers so many different topics, and because that is what the world is. It's a really complex, you know, humans and animal systems and water systems. And, you know, it's a really complex system that we, you know, we need to work in harmony in order mm-hmm. to live, you know, a good life.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just thinking this really encompasses all our activities of life. And I'm just wondering how much buy-in there is, you know, from senior governments. Like, where's the most buy-in? I suspect I know the answer to this question, but where's the most buy-in? Is it the individuals? Do we have buy-in from senior governments? Mm-hmm. What sort of your take on it?
Well, permaculture is a grassroots system. It mm-hmm. is. It really starts from the grassroots level. You can think of permaculture as a toolbox, so filled with tools for building sustainable communities. So that could be food production, urban gardening, sustainable farming practices, green building techniques, responsible energy use, water harvesting, you know, incorporating animals into the system. And then it also talks about, like, you know, health and wellness and finance and economics and community development. And so really it, you know, a lot of the times it is decentralized. It is, mm-hmm. it is, people doing, using permaculture in their communities in order to, but that's, I mean, I guess that's the issue, is that it becomes a community-based movement. So it's not people working in isolation, but mm-hmm. it's, you know, really people working together in their communities to make systems that are really, really functional for mm-hmm. the needs that they have. And every system is different. Every location is different. Every person is different. Every culture is different. So, you know, it just, you have to look at the context of where you are and then adapt permaculture for, you know, your reality.
It strikes me as you're discussing and describing this, is this seems to be kind of an extension of what we used to know in this province as the cooperative movement.
Well, that's part of it. It really is. Permaculture is looking at, like, I guess one of the differences with permaculture is that its focus is on ethics. Like, that's the base of it. And that's the same with cooperatives. Cooperatives have a lot of structural things in its design where, you know, it benefits the people who utilize it. So with permaculture, the ethics are care of earth, care of people, and fair share. So return of surplus. So then that's the same with co-ops, where you would, you know, everybody has a decision-making power in a co-op, and that's the same with permaculture. Like, permaculture is really about relationships and how to make things work together, and people having decision-making power, and people, you know, having control over the things that impact them. And, you know, people are the people that are in the systems are the ones that know what they need and know mm-hmm. how to do it best and are familiar with their local environment. So, you know, it's really democratic, and it allows for people to have decision-making power.
Right. So just sort of taking sort of a practical example, if you're a group of people and you want to do something that's going to improve your food supply, for example, if you're mm-hmm. not, if you're not happy with the food in quality or perhaps quantity or whatever that you were providing for your family, you could get together with a like-minded group of people and study the problem and come up with some solutions and apply them.
Well, that's the thing. I'm glad that you said solutions, because permaculture is not about, like, what's wrong with the world. It's about mm-hmm. what is right about the world and how we can make a better world. And so it really looks for positive solutions and focuses on what we are for instead of focusing on the negatives and what we are against. And so, basically, you know, talking about food production, it is like one of the key keys to permaculture would be perennial crops. So instead of doing annual crops, of course you want to include annual crops, but, and diversity is really important, but perennial crops, one of the main aspects of permaculture is a food forest. So you'd have nine layers, where starting with the canopy and ending with the microorganisms in the soil. And with permaculture too, one of the principles is stacking functions. So for example, the canopy, like, it provides fruit and food and shelter and shade and water capture. So every single layer of the food forest, you know, provides a function for the harmonious working of the rest of the aspects, instead of a monocrop culture where it's like one seed, one variety, which isn't resilient. Like, you know, permaculture food production creates resilience in the system, which is what you need, and it creates diversity. And, you know, you really want to maximize your yield by using different plants, like they call them guilds. So there's the nitrogen fixers and the, you know, just different things that help systems create more than they normally would. So for food production, you know, you do things like plant a diversity of crops, and you'd ensure that you harvest the water so that you don't experience drought conditions, and you want to protect plants from the sun and the wind, and so you really create a system that works in harmony and creates abundance.
So are there any other aspects besides, I guess agriculture is kind of the main focus, but there must be other things that you can sort of use the concept with.
I mean, if you look at, for one thing, would be housing. It would be a really big one, because one of the things in permaculture is natural buildings. So there's things like straw bale, cob, rammed earth, adobe. And it's funny because a lot of these techniques are ancient techniques, or just in general with permaculture, indigenous knowledge is, it's like we're rediscovering indigenous knowledge. It's like what indigenous people did all the time, and we kind of lost it, but now we're regaining those skills. So things like that, where we live in a situation in the world where a lot of people live in slums, and going forward, even more people will live in slums. Like they leave the rural areas, come to the cities. So in terms of permaculture, you would, build natural buildings that breathe better and that have more protection and that are more beautiful. And then, building communities that have, it would be like water and sanitation are really important. So, you want to consider those things when you're talking about like natural building and where people live. And so, it talks about, energy use is another one that's really important to us, because, in the age of peak oil, and even just access to energy and or affordability of energy, it looks at using renewable energy or using less energy. So really it looks at, all aspects of what humans do and what we use.
So just sort of the whole human experience, our needs, what we need to sustain ourselves, and probably what we need to enhance our lives. These are all things that we can come at from a permaculture point of view.
Well, that's the great thing about it, is that I don't know how many of the listeners have ever been on an eco-village or had an experience like that, but it's really about building community and working together and feeling like your voice is being heard, and feeling like you have some say in things, and just being with like-minded people, and it's like a healthy, happy environment. Like really, happiness should be a goal. It's not just about basic needs, but it's like flourishing and having, and like self-actualization, and actually being able to have all of the skills and knowledge and attributes that humans have that really we should be cultivating. And so just to make a better world and to make individuals happier, like, I think happiness is a goal that we should try to attain.
I would have to agree with you. I'm feeling kind of happy right now. I'm just thinking too here, there are probably some skill sets too that that perhaps you don't think of, and probably coming back into fashion. I'm thinking of things like blacksmithing, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I would imagine you have some blacksmiths in your permaculture groups, that sort of thing, or at least sort of older technologies that people don't think of as being important. But when you look at our lives, the way we're living them now, with all the technology, what if all of a sudden all the technology went away?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing. And I mean, it's appropriate technology. And it is to a degree, it's off the grid technology. And while we live in a, you know, we're really privileged and we live in this nice world with all this technology, the majority of humans on Earth do not have that. They don't have access to technology, internet, sanitation, water, you know, they don't have, or land, you know, buildings even, like, so most humans are already in a situation where they don't have technology. You know, we're really, really privileged to have what we have. But, you know, if we want to look at it from a global perspective, but, you know, appropriate technology, it's like things that, like, permaculture really focuses on local, like local materials and local skills and local knowledge. So with technology, it's things that you have in your midst that you can, that are readily available, and you can use them, like you have access to them. So also because they're less energy intensive, because most of the things that we use in terms of technology, like, you know, there's a lot of things embedded in them. There's, there's water embedded in them. There's transportation, there's minerals, there's energy, you know, there's war zones that are created because of the, our desire for material wealth and for technology. So there's a lot, like, I think it's important that everybody looks at the embeddedness of everything that we use and to try and shift to a more, you know, what's more local and what's less in less, you know, labor intensive and energy intensive. And like you say, because if, you know, we've had the situation where we had, you know, there's a lot of natural disasters. So there is people off the grid, people that don't have sanitation locally and that don't have water. And so it's important, like, especially for emergency preparedness, it is important that we, you know, look at those skills and try and regain those skills. And, you know, people might think it's a step backwards, but in my mind, it's just smart that we're, you know, getting prepared, like, not only for disasters, but also just in general to just use less resources, because we know that, you know, we're using resources at an unsustainable rate. And, you know, that it's just either we have to stop doing it or it's going to prevent us from continuing to do that. So the change is going to come. It's just a matter of, you know, when and how it happens.
And will we be prepared?
That's right.
Yeah. Just taking a look here at one of the concepts in permaculture here that really interests me, the concept of zones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're, well, just living anywhere, I suppose, you've got different zones depending on how far away the area is from where you're living, sort of thing.
That's right. So the zones and sectors are really important aspects of permaculture. So, well, zone 00 is people. We can talk about that in a minute. Zone 0 would be the your house, you know, where you spend most of your time. Zone 1 is areas needing continual observation and frequent visits. 2 would be less intensively managed areas. 3 would be occasionally visited areas. So, like, to think of it in a more practical term, for, like, and this was one of the, this is like the first permaculture principle I learned, and I just loved it. It's like, things that you use all the time should be near you. So, for example, your herbs shouldn't be at the back of your yard. They should be right by your door so you can just go out and get them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have chickens or animals, you don't want to have to walk 5 miles to feed them every day. You want them to be, like, say, they're in zone 2. They're, like, near. You have, you don't have, maybe don't have to go to them every day, but you have to go, you know, quite often. And that can be, you can use that in every aspect of your life, like things that, like, making it convenient for yourself and making it easy. And so really with the zones, you want to place elements on your site to reduce your workload, reduce your resource use, reduce maintenance, and then you want to boost yields and diversity and recycle resources and maximize the number of useful relationships, like, you know, so that things work in harmony with each other. Again, it's all about the relationships in permaculture. And just to talk a little bit about like zone 00, you know, it's not working with plants and animals is one thing, you know, that it's actually quite easy, but it's working with humans that is, you know, actually the hardest part about it. So,
I've noticed that,
you know, so we want to work, like, one of the things that permaculture talks about a lot is, like nonviolent communication and anti-oppressive, techniques that you'd use so that, because we have to live in harmony. Like, we want to, first of all, we want to. I mean, I think humans want to get along, but I mean, everybody wants everything done in their way all the time. And it's this interesting thing that, you know, we have to work together, and we have to learn. More importantly, we have to learn how to work together. Like, we have to learn what are other people's needs and what sort of skills and knowledge that people have that we can incorporate into, you know, whatever it is that we're doing. So it's really about acknowledging the skills and abilities and needs and wants of other human beings and really taking those into consideration instead of just thinking of ourselves.
Well, I'm just, my head's just swimming here. Really. So just in a sense, it all seems like common sense.
Well, it is. I mean, really, it's...
This shouldn't be a huge departure from the way we're living now, but in some cases, I think it is.
Well, we live in a pretty individualistic society, and we don't feel like we're dependent on anything. Like, we don't feel like we're dependent on mm-hmm. nature, and we don't feel like we're dependent on each other. But, you know, we are. Mm-hmm. You know, we're really obviously dependent on ecosystems that support us. But also, you know, we, again, if something were to happen, I mean, we really need to be in a community in order to, you know, survive and thrive in a way. And, you know, humans are social creatures. You know, we want to be with us. We want to build community and we want to break down barriers and, you know, we really want to look at things through an anti-oppressive lens. Like, we want to accept everybody, you know, for who they are and not judge them based on whatever it is we judge them on and just really, like, really create, like, peace and harmony and joy and love mm-hmm. and, you know, these sound, you know, that might sound funny, but, you know, really I think that it would make a better world and humans, like, humans desire that and, mm-hmm. and then, you know, we just want to, you know, make a better world and, you know, create happiness.
Right, right. How would somebody pursue these goals? Like, if you're in an really urban environment, like we are right now, we're in, well, relatively urban in Regina,
mm-hmm.
Because some of the stuff that we're reading about and talking about with permaculture seems to be like for people who have an acreage or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So what could somebody do? I'm thinking of one in particular, you know? And you probably know of some people. They come from maybe they've come from someplace like Ukraine or some European mm-hmm. country, and they look at our lawns.
Oh.
And they think that we're absolutely crazy.
Well, lawns are a problem. Yes, they are. It's instead of lawns, we could be producing food and. Part of it, I guess, too, is like a cultural shift. Like, it's work. That's the thing. Like, I mm-hmm. actually talked to this landscape architect and I was saying, you know, I wish the city would grow food. You know, I wish we had a food security plan in the city and we had, you know, the resources to support it. And it's like, well, it's too much maintenance. You know, it costs too much money. It's like, well, you know, transporting food from 5,000 kilometers away also has an impact. Like, that costs a lot of money, you know? And it's like, if you did the full cost accounting on it. But no, but like, and plus there are a lot of hungry people, like, in the world, but also in Regina and in urban areas. And, you know, to grow food instead of lawns would be, like, that's revolutionary. That mm-hmm. would change the world. And we live in a time of food insecurity. Like, we mm-hmm. don't think we do. We go to the store and the, mm-hmm. you know, the shelves are full, but the highway was closed. The highway annually, the highway, you know, across Canada, it somehow gets flooded and is closed. Well, that's how our food gets here. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, if the border was closed or whatever is going to happen, I mean, we don't have food security. We don't have a, you know, a supply of food. So, you know, growing food locally is smart. Mm-hmm. And when you talked about, like, what are governments doing, you know, really we need policies and political will to look at the big picture and have vision and to say we need to grow food locally. And economically, like, it really, I mean, you can do all this value added as well. You can do, producing jam and preserving food and producing meals and just, you know, so it really, there's money to be made in it too. There's an economy in it instead of, you know, getting our food from so far away from, you know, oftentimes it's people working to produce our food that, you know, aren't having their human rights met and are being exploited, you know, if it's local, you know, first of all, it tastes better and it's, you know, healthier, but, you know, there's an ethics to it where people aren't being harmed in the process of us eating, you know, cheap food from other places. So, you know, it helps us, it helps them. It's really a win-win situation. And like I said, it's just smart because we have food insecurity, and we don't think we do, but we do. You know, we're in a situation where we really need to be growing our own food and producing more food locally.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, you think, again, how fragile our system really is,
mm-hmm.
you know. And if you've ever worked in retail,
mm-hmm.
you know that you've got stuff coming in the back door as it's going out the front.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have a lot of stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
They like to have maybe, 30 days worth of stuff,
mm-hmm.
if that.
Yeah.
You know, so all that has to happen is our methods of transportation shut down for whatever reason. And all of a sudden, we're looking around to see where else we can find something to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And makes the farmer's market or something like that really look like a good option.
And obviously I'm not opposed to trade, you know, and the Saskatchewan climate can't grow food all year. And so we are dependent on, like, we can do it like our bioregional food shed. You know, we can get food, like Manitoba produces a ton of food, you know, Saskatchewan produces so many lentils and pulses and chickpeas and that sort of thing that gets exported to other places and then re-imported so we can buy it. So it's important that, you know, some of the food that we do produce is available locally. And it's important that we, you know, we are able to get food from other places in the world. Like, I'm interested in diverse foods. Like, I'm lucky that I get to eat all kinds of foods, and that's one of the joys of life. So I'm not saying that everything has to be local, but more local food is definitely something we should be doing.
Well, Denise, I was looking at some songs about permaculture and just looking at my computer here right now while you were talking, and I found one, but I'm not going to play it right away. We have to have a break first. Okay.
Great.
So we're going to take our break, and we're going to come back and listen to some permaculture music. And we'll continue our discussion. So we'll be right back.
I wake up every morning. Every night I go to bed. Like everybody I was born in, like everybody someday I'll be dead. Like the sun rising and the sun going down, it's all working to a pattern that keeps the whole thing going round. Always in patterns that keep coming around, around, around. It's the way it happens. Round and round and round and around. Gotta see the bigger picture before looking at the small. If you can't see the forest for the trees, then you're not really seeing at all. Before you do anything, gotta know how it's done. A pattern to the details, you'll be halfway there before you've even begun. Get to know your patterns, they'll tell you what you need to know. Like what the weather's doing, if there's rain or brewing, to how to make your garden grow. We can rely on patterns,
you can learn them faster. Train your brain to retain them, become a pattern master. Geometry in broccoli, or all these rhyming words. It really blows my mind the way it's all designed. Oh, I'm not religious, but it's prodigious, all these patterns in this world of mine. Everything's in patterns with the answers at your fingertip. It's a dynamic relationship. Life's just one big Mobius trip. If you can disprove patterns, well, I'll eat my hat and maybe just move to Batteratton, become a diplomat and get really fat and just talk and scat and scribble do be do be do 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 do
do do do do do do Yeah, Charlie McGee, I believe. Found him on YouTube, and there's lots of permaculture music there. So, which I'm talking about ukuleles. I'm gonna digress here a little bit. I was just telling Denise there is a ukulele group in town, and they are meeting regularly and having a great time. I haven't been there yet. Where do you get the time for this? You know, but I think I'll hopefully find some time. I'm busy doing mandolining, you know, still. But yeah, ukuleles, wow. Which brings me to the other point I wanted to discuss, sort of the social aspect of permaculture, the permaculture community. And it just strikes me, as our singer was kind of demonstrating, you got a bunch of people there who are having a good time.
Well, like I said, it's a huge social movement that is growing every day. There is permaculture convergences all over the world. I was lucky enough to go to the permaculture convergence in Cuba in last November. And it was my first one, and there were 420 people from 47 countries there. It was so incredible. Wow. To hear everybody's perspective on permaculture and what they're doing. And, you know, we talked a little bit about skills earlier, and that's the thing. Like, you come together in these permaculture convergences, you learn from each other, you see what works for people and how you can incorporate these ideas. And I mean, I think that's the most beautiful thing about it, is like the human spirit and just our abundant creativity and what we can accomplish when we set our minds to it and work together, and how fun it is to be creative. Like, you know, there's just so much we can do. But this Cuba, I had never been to Cuba before, and it was fantastic. Like, I highly recommend it to everybody. There was a 3-day conference in Havana, a 1-day tour of urban gardens, a 5-day convergence, and then a 3-day tour of rural farms and gardens.
Wow.
And because, I mean, Havana or Cuba was in a situation where they, you know, they basically got off fossil fuels, and they're a shining example of what is possible. And also, they're one of the only places on Earth that actually lives within their ecological footprint. You know, they are sustainable. And one of the other things I noticed when I was there was all the birds. Like, there's so much habitat and there's so many birds, and wow. I just loved it. Like, and it was just incredible to learn from, you know, from everybody. At the convergence itself, there were 30 workshops a day that we could go to. So I went to, you know, workshops on food sovereignty, peak oil, permaculture for nutrition. And I know I love that one because it's the idea of planting a garden that has all of the range of nutrients that you need. So thinking really strategically about what you're growing, you know, gray water, urban permaculture, especially in food deserts, because in urban areas, there's lots of places where, you know, the food isn't accessible to everybody, and especially in low income areas. So, you know, and it's that idea. There's a lot of places in the United States that have revitalized their urban, you know, inner cities through food production and reclaiming, you know, vacant lots and producing food and building community. And, you know, it transforms communities. And, you know, they say there's, you know, when people are fed, I mean, that's a basic need, a basic right, and it you know, it reduces violence and it improves health and happiness. And, like, it's, you know, it seems so basic, but, you know, really what you need is, you need soil, which you create. You can create soil through a composting program. You know, you need water, which you can harvest from, you know, rainwater, and you need seeds, and you need, you know, you need people to get involved. So I'm not saying that it's like the easiest thing that you can do, but it is transformative. And so, yeah, so it's a real, like, it's urban, it's rural, it's global, it's local, it's, you know, it's basically anybody can get involved in it. There's so much going on. I mean, I really highly recommend that people, you know, look on the internet at permaculture. Any, like, if you're interested in blacksmithing, there's information about that. If you're interested in microclimates and growing limes in Regina, you can, you know, look at that. If you're interested in natural building, you know, there's just so many different things that you can do. And I was lucky enough to go out to Crake recently and do a couple of workshops. I just love that part of permaculture, is just the skills building and kind of the DIY, like, do it yourself culture mm-hmm. that there is. So I learned how to make cob, and I also learned how to make a stone wall without mortar.
What is cob? Pardon me.
Oh, cob. Cob is sand, clay, and straw and water, and you mix it together. You get to mix it with your feet, which is really fun. Yeah, like, there's a lot of fun things that happen in permaculture too, just so you know. So you make cob, and then it becomes hard like bricks, so you can use it to build homes, and it's really amazing. Like,
so is this sort of an ancient brick making technology? Because it sounds reminiscent to me of like biblical stuff. You know, how people made bricks in the Middle East, that type of thing.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, cob itself, it isn't actually bricks. It's more of like layers. It's a monolithic layer. So you could make, you know, different structures out of it. Whereas adobe is more actually making bricks.
Okay.
So it would be more like the traditional building of bricks. But I mean, that's the thing. You can make whatever you can. Make whatever you want and however you want it. Like, you just need to, whatever's locally available in your area, you take that and you adapt it to your conditions. Everybody, like, some places it's wet and some places it's dry and some places are sloped and some places are cold. Like, you know, it's whatever it is that your situation is. Like, it's not a monoculture, you know, it really reflects the diversity of our realities. And so you can basically adapt permaculture to anything that you're doing in all aspects of your life every single day. So, you know, that's the really good thing about the diversity of it. But just, like, it was so fun to work in the mud and use stones. Like, I don't look at stones the same anymore. And just, like, really being connected to nature, like, really grounded in you know, what supports us. And I don't know, it just made me feel really good. And you know, to get away from the sort of the electronics and the computer and just listen to the birds, and like, it does make a difference in your life. You know, it makes you feel better.
Yep. I have been at that restaurant at Crake
and
I've wandered around there several times just in awe of the different simple passive systems that they use to stay cool, stay warm, that type of thing, and preserve, you know, the energy, and everything is so simple, you know, and you wonder why some of these techniques haven't been used in more modern building.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, like it is happening at the grassroots level, and there's lots of people that have lots of skills, and you can get the training, and, you know, it is happening. But, you know, I don't know that there's many architecture schools that actually incorporate natural building. You know, I mean, I think they will eventually, but that just isn't, you know, what we're doing right now. But there is ways. I mean, you can learn. There's books and articles and trainings and, you know, examples all over the world. There's ancient buildings that have been used, like, you know, using these techniques that, I mean, these techniques could be seen to be more durable than some of the buildings, like some of the condos and buildings that we're putting up today. So to think that they're really not technologically advanced is not true. Like they really are. So there's just so many opportunities to learn and to create things that are more sustainable.
I don't know whether I mentioned to you before or not, but I was hoping to have one of my cohorts, Holly, here. And Holly was unable to come because she has a cold and she didn't want to pass it on to us. But she did send me an email. And she had a few thoughts. And, okay. She says, I know there are examples in Africa where desert has been converted to trees that can hold water and people are now able to fish there. Is that not messing with nature more so than restoring it? How do we know what is too far?
Well, I guess there was an instance where the Sahara Desert was, the wind was taking the Sahara Desert and it ended up in London, England. And they, you know, it was quite a, you know, problem for people in London, like in terms of like the airport and the air quality and that sort of thing. And so at a time when there's so much desertification, as well as ice caps melting, like almost at the same rate, the less ice caps there are, the more desert there is. And it's this system. So in my mind, like that's too far, you know, that is something that we have to try and stop. And desertification is a huge problem, but, you know, mainly it's because of deforestation. And a lot of it is, you know, deforestation for use for, you know, people in the West who want to redo their floors and get new decks and build bigger houses and whatever it is. So a lot of the wood is exported, but a lot of it is used for firewood and, you know, for, you know, people's domestic needs. But permaculture, really one of the main aspects of permaculture is to build the soil. So it is true, you can reclaim deserts. There's a video about greening the oasis in Jordan. And, you know, basically it's using the products. So, for example, say with sugar cane, you'd use the stalks. And like with straw bale, you use the stalks of the plant. So instead of that being considered waste and burnt or put in the landfill, you actually use everything. Like permaculture doesn't see anything as waste. It's a zero waste system. So everything is a resource. So you would use these products to mulch the soil. You'd make sure instead of composting, instead of putting it in the garbage, you would use the compost to build the soil. You would use humanure, so, and nitrogen from urine. You'd use animal manure for enriching the soil. Like really it's about building the soil. It's, you know, topsoil is endangered right now. It's what we rely on for food production. It's quite easy to build the soil, and that is one of the main you know, things that we need to be doing. And then also to prevent runoff, because we are having so many problems with flooding. So if you build the soil, then it captures the water instead of running off, or, you know, it makes it that the water can be absorbed. So, you know, building the soil helps with, like, it captures carbon, it captures water, it stops flooding, it, you know, builds the soil so you can grow food. Like, you know, so I think we need to try and mitigate the things that are happening, like when it comes to like desertification and that sort of thing. It's not as though we're going back to nature. Almost every piece of earth has been impacted by humans. So it's not that we're doing, it's how we're doing it.
You know, just in line with that, my in-laws have got a cottage, and in one of the cottages, they have put a composting toilet. And it works very well. And of course, the big benefit of that is that you're not polluting groundwater.
That's right.
You know, so to go a little further from that, our model now, like with a place like Regina, is we have this massive sewer system and treatment plant and all the rest of it. I wonder if we're doing this the hard way.
Well, on the way over here, actually, I just heard a program on CBC, and Edmonton has a public composting toilet.
Wow.
And they were talking about like how like composting toilets are really cool.
Mm-hmm.
People that... Okay, so, well, first of all, 1% of the water on Earth is available, is fresh water and available for our use.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you go to the bathroom in it? Is yep. one thing.
And then flush it away with more fresh water.
Yeah. And basically, people think, oh, you know, humanure is toxic. But actually, putting it into a water system is actually more toxic than, oh, I mean, they treat it with chemicals. And but it does go downstream. I mean, yeah, sure. We've learned that there's lots of E. coli in the water right now from humans and animals because of the flooding. So there was a situation in New Zealand where there was an earthquake and mm-hmm. in Christchurch, and the entire sewer system collapsed. And so they now have an emergency composting toilet program. Like, that's emergency preparedness. Mm-hmm, that is mm-hmm. smart. That is good thinking. Like, thank you to the government for having vision.
Mm-hmm.
And so... you know, people don't like to talk about it. I mean, and that was one of the main workshop topics, or one of the issues that was talked about in Cuba, was most humans don't have access to sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a basic right. It's a matter of providing, you know, dignity to people, and that composting toilets are extremely user friendly. And because of the way it works, if you heat them, like mm-hmm. it ends up with, if like, because you have your air and your water and your humanure, and it gets to a temperature where all of the parasites and bacteria and all of the toxins get destroyed by the heat. Mm-hmm. So you have to leave it for a while. You definitely mm-hmm. have to leave it for a year or two for right. sure. But it kills all of the any of the pathogens and things that are dangerous. So we have Permaculture Book Club, and we read the Humanure Handbook, which mm-hmm. was such a great book. I highly recommend it to everybody. It was wonderful. And, you know, they call people that are afraid of humanure fecophobes. And you might be afraid of it, but it's a reality. It's a yeah. reality. And not, I mean, for us, yes, we flush it away, although, you know, it does go into the creeks and it goes into the lakes, and people, you know, it's definitely, it doesn't, nothing goes away. You know, mm-hmm, everything mm-hmm. is here still. We are still impacted by it. But more importantly, from a global perspective, it's like making sure that humans all over the world have access to sanitation. And that is where composting toilets come in. And it's just important, you know, in lakes, like you say, you mm-hmm. pollute the groundwater. It's, and then plus it's a resource. Like, we're wasting mm-hmm. it. The nitrogen in urine and all of the nutrients, like, it's such good fertilizer mm-hmm. and it's a resource. Like, why would you take a resource and just throw it away? You know, we should be using it. And it is possible. People are doing, like I said, in New Zealand, they're doing it mm-hmm. and all over the world. Like, it's just a really smart thing to do.
Yeah. Wow. Just, yeah, I was impressed by it myself when I sort of considered it. They decided, they did it as an option to, they do have, you know, a septic bed and that sort mm-hmm. of thing. And that's quite expensive.
It is.
And the composting toilet is way cheaper.
Well, and the Craig Eco Center has a composting toilet too. So if anybody wanted to see one in action, you mm-hmm. can actually go to the Craig Eco Center and see them. And I mean, I guess this is where we kind of need to talk about like zoning and codes and that sort of thing, where things are, there's laws and rules and regulations around a lot of things. And so there should be. You want people to be structurally sound. Like, you want buildings to be structurally sound, and you want water systems to be clean, and you want it to be safe. Like, there are regulations and rules for a reason. Absolutely no doubt about it. But I mean, for example, gray water systems, where your shower and dishwater can go, can be reused instead mm-hmm. of going into the sewer system, and you know, being able to do natural building instead of using concrete and drywall and endangered products that come from far away. You know, so in Oregon. Oregon's a really, if anybody has a chance, they should look up cityrepair.org. It's this fantastic organization. They do these great things. And in Oregon, they're really, really progressive. They're like on the leading edge of all of this. And they've basically, they're recoding, like they're talking to the city and they're getting, you know, rules and regulations around more natural building. And it is possible. It's absolutely possible. And, but you do have to be smart about it. You know, you don't want to put anybody in harm's way, but, you know, it is possible that we could have gray water systems. We could have composting toilets. You know, we can have natural buildings. We can do all of these things. We can have public, like Toronto composts. Mm-hmm. Like, why can't, and they also have chickens, like urban chickens. Like, why can't we have it? If Toronto can do it, we can do it too.
I wasn't aware of that. Toronto has urban chickens?
Yeah, a lot of cities have these chickens are legal
urban
yeah,
chickens?
Yeah, it's not part of the chicken underground.
Yeah, I have heard of, the chicken underground.
Yeah, no, there's lots of places. And I mean, of course there's concerns. There's noise concerns. There's pollution concerns. Absolutely. Yep. But
they
if you regulate it and educate people in a way, it's totally possible. I mean, the possibilities are endless. And I mean, I would say that, you know, we're being harmed more by this system than that system. Like, to a degree, you know, that isn't less safe than this is. So, and it's just to look at the shining examples of other communities and to know. But I mean, again, it takes vision. It takes, you know, it takes political will. It takes effort and time. And, you know, so like we are developing a new sewage treatment plant in Regina, which, you know, is costing a lot of money. We have landfill issues. Like, you know, it's like, I want them to make sure that it's smart design. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the thing about permaculture. It's smart.
And, you know, we have water supply issues as well.
Like, we
right,
sure do.
Right at the moment, water's fine. But look a little ways down the road, the glaciers are melting in the mountains. They're receding. That's where a lot of our water comes from.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and so there's going to come a time when our supply of potable water is going to be in doubt.
Yeah, and we're going to regret it. That's the thing about it is that, like, it's just the wasting of things. It's not the using of things. I mean, obviously, you need to, you know, eat food and drink water and buy things and, you know, get dressed in the morning and live somewhere. Like, it's not about using things. It's not about that.
Yeah.
It's about using too much, and mainly it's more about wasting. We waste the majority of everything. Like, the vast majority of everything we touch, we waste. And there's so much food waste and, you know, and that is the thing that we want to, like, zero waste to me is, like, really near and dear to my heart. I just think, you know, if we can, obviously we're going to use resources, but let's use them really, you know, consciously and sustainably.
Well, Denise, we're just about out of time here, so I thought maybe we should spend the next few minutes talking about the Permaculture Research Institute of Saskatchewan and various other, what's happening in Saskatchewan as far as permaculture is concerned.
Okay, well, the Permaculture Research Institute of Saskatchewan, and there's permaculture research institutes around the world too, so that is based in Saskatoon, and they're doing excellent work. They're doing workshops. One of the things that permaculture does, it's called a permablitz. So you would go to somebody's yard and you would, you know, do a permaculture design. So you would make sure that you'd harvest the water and you'd plant food and you'd get rid of the lawn and you'd, you know, you'd make a place for hammocks, like, you know, things that are beautiful. Like, art comes into permaculture a lot. So, you know, a beautiful functional system. So, that's one of the things that permaculture does and the Permaculture Institute of, in Saskatoon, and just doing, they're doing like soil food web workshops and just, you know, the PDCs, the Permaculture Design Certificate, you can get certificates through them.
I'm just going to mention one event here. On Thursday, July 24th, an evening presentation in Saskatoon by Taylor, how do you pronounce his name? Krasik? Okay, we'll go with that. And Solara Goldwyn of Hatcher and Seed Applied Permaculture, Resiliency Planning for a Changing Climate. So that's on the 24th. And you can look this up on the internet. And on Saturday the 26th, a one-day workshop at Happy Bug Farms Hatchet and Seed.
That's right. And there's also activities happening in Yorkton. There's a group that does stuff there. Ness Creek has a permaculture site. So the Ness Creek Festival is happening right now.
Yes.
And they have a beautiful food forest there, and it's wonderful. And then in Regina, we have like Permaculture Regina. So like I mentioned before, we have the Permaculture Book Club, which anybody is, able to join. Like we read one of the main permaculture books, A Beginner's Guide. And then we read, the Humanure Handbook, which was awesome and led to wonderful conversations. And then now we're reading a rainwater harvesting guide. And so, you know, we meet once a month and we pick books that are important to permaculture. We have a great discussion, building community and having so much fun. And also we've done a couple of field trips. So we get out of the city as well. So we went to the wastewater treatment plant and toured that, which was very interesting. And then more recently we went to the Creek Eco Village to meet the people out there and learn. So really we want to learn new skills, new knowledge, be together, have fun. We're at www.permaregina.ca. And then we're at permacultureregina@gmail.com. So, and then we have the Permaculture Regina group on Facebook. So I really highly recommend that if anybody wants to get involved, we don't do as much over the summer, but we do usually monthly learning opportunities for people on many different topics. So please come out and join us because it's very fun.
Denise McDonald, thank you very much for being with us and talking about permaculture.
Thanks for having me.
As we close this week's Human Rights Radio and CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."
This is the Talent Pool on 91.3 FM, CJTR, a look at Regina's live music scene.
At Casino Regina Show Lounge on Saturday and Sunday, Rory Allen with his Elvis tribute. And on Wednesday the 23rd, the Saskatchewan Flood Relief Concert featuring 11 different Saskatchewan artists. That's at Casino Regina Show Lounge. At Bushwhacker, Monday Night Jazz and Blues on July 21st features the Matt Taylor Jazz Group. And on Wednesday the 23rd, it's Chad Kachula and The Garage offering up Americana Roots for Folk Night at Bushwhacker Brewing Company, 2206 Dewdney Avenue. Moose Jaw Cultural Center on Wednesday the 23rd, Saskatchewan Express on their Shake It Up Summer Tour. And July 31st to August 17th, the musical Singing in the Rain. That's at the Moose Jaw Cultural Center, 217 Main Street North. The 10th Annual Gateway Festival coming up quick, July 25th through 27th, featuring the Sheepdogs, Tim Hicks, the Sadies, and lots more. Go to their website for ticket and artist information at gatewayfestival.com.
This has been the Talent Pool on 91.3 FM, CJTR, Regina Community Radio.
Celebrate the human spirit together this summer with the Regina Folk Festival. An incredible mix of diverse musicians including Serena Ryder, Sam Roberts Band, Indigo Girls, Los Lobos, and Joel Plaskett Emergency, along with interactive visual arts, amazing food and drink, squishy grass, and happy people. August 8th to 10th in Victoria Park. Visit reginafolkfestival.com for all the necessary details.
91.3 FM, CJTR, Regina Community Radio. Our programming is made possible by community-minded organizations like the Friends of the Royal Saskatchewan Museum and by listeners like you.
So are you looking for the answers? All the questions that you have, and now you're rolling with science, or does religion have your back? It's hard to think about the future when you're living far behind. You think that we can work it out, but I don't have the time. No, I don't care what you say, 'cause I'm not listening anyway. When we talk about this mess, think you're really happy with that diamond around your neck? And does he seem to be faithful, or does he lie behind your back? You know, lately I've been thinking that I still want you in my life. I'm trying to admit it, the grass wasn't greener on the other side. So I don't care what you say, you're not. What I've been told, seeing you mad is getting fucking old. You keep this up, you're gonna be like